Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, you are going to hear the second part of an interview with Joseph McElroy, the author most recently of Actress in the House, published by the Overlook Press. His books are being brought back into print by that house, beginning with the first novel, A Smuggler's Bible. One of the critics, I think it was Walker Percy, said when that book came out that to ignore it would make the culture as guilty as they had been when they didn't recognize Under the Volcano and the Recognitions. That's a quote that I love. Another person says it's like encountering an underwater cathedral, a shard. And, you know, I can only say that over the many years, around 25, 30, that I've been reading Joe McElroy, I think of this as being the unexplored, the unmined motherlode of American literature. So it's with enormous awe and respect and deference that I have him as my guest. Now, there's something I haven't understood about the books, which is that, like certain other books, Lolita, say, there is the form of a subgenre. In Plus, it's science fiction. In Lookout Cartridge, it's an international thriller. In Actress in the House, at least by its cover and opening scene, there's a kind of James M. Cain brutality between a man and a woman. The shock that people felt at seeing in a certain kind of noir an actress's face pushed into a grapefruit or a woman being struck. And yet, unlike, say, Robe Grier's The Erasers or Borges's story Death in the Compass, which actually did appear in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine in its first American appearance, these books seem to move almost immediately out of the realm of their genre. They don't really seem to be interested in it, and yet it seems to be a gesture toward easiness or reader friendliness that the books don't seem in general to be thinking much about otherwise. And I wondered about that impulse.
It might be that the genres you mention, the kinds of maybe popular narrative that you mention, which I certainly would never disparage, are points of departure to release what is in me and what is in them. I think that the turns that I take once that thing has started are not really turns into popular culture as you see it in some American writers now, much less in television, but rather into the languages of different disciplines in America. I think that's a way that I connect with the landscape that's around me. But I think the city has always enabled me to stay close to what I think is the swirl, the reality. I think that architecture is important in my work. The building of not only the building of structures out of words, but actual buildings, buildings in which things take place. And I think of women and men as being a multidimensional structure that is spinning as we enter it. It becomes an apartment house, but it becomes the United States and it becomes the globe. And I think that the building metaphor in many ramifications always has meant an awful lot to me. Does architecture mean a lot to me? Yeah. Do I know something about it? Only as an amateur. It's connected to my interest in earthquakes, which is, there's a little bit of that in this book. And earthquakes are shocks which dislodge structures, and people may be in those structures and may be hurt and changed and killed and all of that. But structures are to be dwelled in, as Heidegger says in that essay about building and dwelling and thinking. And I think of my books as structures that are possibly even useful, in which, although you want to get to the end, you wonder what's going to happen at the end. Are these two people going to be together, or will they not be together at the end? And if they're not together at the end, does that mean that it was all a waste? As you think of these things about the end, and as you think inevitably of getting to the end, which is part of the American desire to get to the end fast, I think of my books more as being books to dwell in. And if that means to reread, as Faulkner suggested, and I guess Proust implicitly has suggested that we reread what we have just read, I would hesitate to say that to a reader. But there are other aspects of dwelling in the prose that is other than rereading that are possible. And it may just be reading patiently. But it means also, I think, having a certain kind of excited contentment while being in a scene, which is in addition to the terrible urge to get, by means of the logic of the book, to the next thing, to the next thing. And so the Heidegger essay about building having to do with dwelling, but dwelling having to do with comfort, even if you are in a structure that is in motion and that isn't exactly like a house to live in, meant so much to me.
I'm speaking to Joe McElroy, the author most recently of Actress in the House, published by Overlook Press, and you're listening to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Now, one of the feelings in Actress in the House amounts to me to complete mystery. From time to time, there'll be choices made in these books. For instance, I'm very amused, almost like an advertisement in the first novel, A Smuggler's Bible, a book that I found that actually exists called Wisdom, Madness, and Folly by a man. Do you remember the author's name?
It'll come back to me.
Yes.
I know the book better than the author.
Page. John Custance. This book is recommended with almost demonic regularity every 10 or 12 pages or so in A Smuggler's Bible. I thought it was a complete invention until I happened to find it on the shelf of a used bookstore. Similarly, in Actress in the House, at a certain point, the hero, Daly, comes to suspect that most of the people he meets are either divers or diving coaches.
Well, now that's a passing generalization.
And yet, you know, it does.
Well, the book is partly about falling. And if this is not giving something away, at the end, in a war memory, there is a distinction made between two ways of falling. One is when you've been pushed, and another one, which is hard to see there at the end, but I meant it to be hard to see. It's a secret there, but it's there for the reader. The other way is if you jump. And from the beginning of this book, although I didn't understand it until I was done and I look back at it, there's a question of falling. And I don't mean falling in love, but that the actress who is smacked very nearly falls off the stage. And this is verisimilitude, you could say. This really makes it a good scene. But we know, and Daly, the main character, knows, sitting in the eighth row, that she's been hit so hard that it's over the line. There's something going on between the actress and the young actor up there, something that is from off stage that's brought on, and he's mad as hell at her. And it isn't just the brother that he's playing, into whose life she has meddled, and we learn later how she did that. That's the story of the play. It's much more than that. It's something going on between the actor and the actress, and he hits her so hard that she very nearly falls, and I want the reader to feel that. And at a number of points further into the book, there are instances of descent from a high place, either diving or jumping or being off balance or falling, the threat of falling from a high place, above a river, for example.
Well, as I was reading and rereading the opening chapters, I saw that the first words are a shock, and then in chapter two, we encounter a jolt repeated, and then in three, a tremor or tremor leading to talk about earthquakes, and eventually,
which of course is a real earthquake.
Yes. Yeah. Eventually, what we come to see is that in addition to these words of jolting and shocking, the word absorbing, in other words, that the book is about how do you absorb a shock, about shock absorption.
Yes, and in a way transform it through absorbing it.
Yes.
And I believe we're supposed to feel that the actress has been through some kind of hell. And we don't know, even at the end, all that she's been through.
But not only that, a good book is described as absorbing. And so taking this in, the reader is required to absorb all kinds of shocks and figure out ways of handling them.
I think that's true. And it's the taking in of shock is not separable, not ever separable. It's conjoined to the instinctive desire to control it by almost not admitting it. And so that opening sentence, a shock, that's all it was. A shock, comma, that's all it was. Is important not only because of the shock, but because there's something in the point of view character here who says, oh, well, it's only another shock, you know. I mean, and Daly's clocked some mileage. He really has. He's a strong guy. But that strength carries in it a desire also maybe not to admit fully the shocks that he's been through.
Now, you were speaking about architecture before. And I want to talk about an extension of what I think architecture does. That is to say that sentences and their grammar in these novels are the joists and struts of their architecture. And to learn what a sentence does, a sentence as a blueprint, as diagramming sentences. And so all kinds of things keep happening if you become really sensitized, as the prose almost insists you be by its constant changes of shape, of tense, of sentence structure. From, at least as far as I know, Heinz Kidnap on, there's the interest in change of perspective. In that book, there's a Durer etching, which at first looks like, I think, cliffs and a mountain scene that turns into a face of Jesus. But similarly, words do that as well. And so in that book, our hero, Hind, is very, very tall. In fact, he's given to saying without being asked, 6'5", because people are always asking him his height or about to. But we learn something about Hind's height, which is hindsight. And as he looks for a lost child, he's recovering his own lost childhood. And eventually, although he's had as this project a kidnap to find this child, and therefore it's Hind's kidnap, but Hind is neither the kidnapped child nor the kidnapper, and he is the kidnapped child and the kidnapper in peculiar senses. So that
One's hindsight has been kidnapped and then recovered.
Right. And now these things, you see, led McElroy to be compared to all sorts of puns and anagrams kinds of writers. But I think, in fact, what's being looked for in these grammars and these tricks with apostrophe S in Heinz Kidnap is the structure of language as it's held in the human brain and makes us mean something else as we say what we think we would like to mean.
Oh, I think so. And if I were to put it in the form of a spatial pattern, this is kind of a glib image, I would think of some of Pollock's paintings.
Tell me more.
The spread formed but unpredictable of those streaks and those dots, which honestly might sometimes suggest a Golgi stain of the brain, that Italian neuroanatomist. But I think what I'm trying to say is that the way language narrates in sentences, in grammar, and so forth, sometimes comes close to being a diagram of what might almost be physically an anatomy of the brain. I say almost. I really want to say almost because I'm not doing a kind of science, but I think that image of the brain as an unknown place, imaged almost like a Pollock abstract, is in my mind often when the unpredictable developments within the sentence are taking place.
Now, I'm speaking to Joe McElroy, and I want to confess or confide that when I was reading my first McElroy novel, it had put me into such a state of alarm, stupor, astonishment, that my mother suggested that I stop reading it, that this might be the book, like the chivalric romance that would finally unhinge Don Quixote, that this might be the straw that broke the camel's back. But just as a reader may experience something like madness when reading these books, one feels that the author, too, has had to pass through states that are akin to madness. And I wondered about that, because the books really do feel, both in their composition and in their reception, as if they are designed to imperil ordinary comprehension, that what we must begin with these books is incomprehension or a new kind of comprehension.
I think that's true, and I don't think I can define that new kind of comprehension. I think it would be presumptuous of me to, and I'm not even sure that I've done that. But it's a little bit related to various themes of chaos, both scientifically advertised and defined, and your old garden variety chaos that you wake up with in the morning or experience late at night. I think I wanted to admit as much of that into the otherwise rather careful structures of my books as I could without upsetting the book, because it seemed more honest and it seemed more true to the way I live. And it would be self-involved to get into how I feel when I'm at certain points in writing a book. I feel happy when I'm happier when I'm writing than. But I think there's a willingness to be disordered, a willingness to recognize the disorder in oneself that one has to have always available. It's there. It would be false for me to deny it. And I love Jane Austen. You know, I love extremely orderly and clear writers, which is maybe to do her a disservice, because her irony is enormously complex, as we all know. But the prose style is quite different from mine.
Now, I want to turn to a concluding subject. I'm speaking to Joseph McElroy, author most recently of Actress in the House, published by Overlook Press. Some years ago, I met Joe McElroy, and he startled me. It wasn't something I would have expected. He told me that he was preparing an anthology of love poetry. This never, to my knowledge, has been published.
No.
But
I wrote an introduction to it, which, in fact, I've delivered a couple of times.
But it did strike me when I was reading Actress in the House that love and what its definition might be and why one might fail at it while coming to a recognition of it seemed more central to this book than to any of the others. It is, as you say, a love story. And
I think so. I noticed in one of the reviews, which are demanding reviews, I must say, I think it was in the TLS, the reviewer who had read the book carefully said that McElroy seems unable to present a romance or a love story without showing its national and global and other complex implications. And I think that's true, but I would put it in a different way, that these are interesting people. These are interesting people. I'm not afraid to have them talk. And what I hope is that what comes up in the talk is always organically related to what's going on between them and to the plunge forward to what is going to happen. One of the problems in the book was that I knew I wanted them to take a long walk. It was essential. And people do that in the city. And lovers do it, and people who are not yet lovers, and they are not yet at that point. I think I was wanting the possibility that they could talk about anything at all, and that this would be a sign of their ability to give themselves to each other, but to the world.
In fact, what I thought about was something that Stanley Cavell says when talking about what he calls the comedy of remarriage, that talking, the ability of endless conversation, is central to this genre, which he considers to be the equivalent of Shakespearean romance. He finds it in screwball comedy, in Bringing Up Baby, in His Girl Friday, in The Awful Truth. But here, too, we have a man who's been married to a dancer who has been in a kind of hibernation. And he's coming back to the world to re-encounter, this time, an actress. But this actress is going to take him through a tour, in a sense, of the family and its abuses. She's going to provide a one-woman show of the things that can happen.
We have the one-woman show in Capsule, in literal actuality, but then the one-woman show is her in the whole book.
Yes, exactly. And
it never occurred to me before, what you just said, but I think his show becomes more than a one-man show.
He's being tutored in bringing in otherliness into his consciousness. And it was something that Della, his first wife, tried to show him, and he was privileged to witness it as he began to realize that the people in the modern dance company were not just a bunch of fruits, but contained in their motion possibilities. And he becomes a reader of motion and, in this case, shock. And the idea that learning how to cushion the shock is an act of love.
Yes, cushion the shock. At the same time that cushioning the shock for other people may be a caretaking, which is unrealistic.
Always a danger in these books with people who want to experience others in themselves without appropriating them, and yet find themselves either losing themselves or losing the other. This book seems to have, in what seems like the ability of either character to leave, an independence within interdependence.
Yes, I think so. And I've noticed in the readings that I've been giving around the country that I never seem to read passages from the first marriage because they are there. They were very difficult to place in the narrative, but they're very important to place, and because they're there as memory. And you have to be careful that doesn't become static, and you have to be very sure that it's introduced in a way that at a moment when the reader must have that information. But the marriage with the dancer, when Daly felt an outsider, and there was something not quite right about the marriage, and its childlessness was part of the sign of it, but it was much more than that, that's his past, and it's a very enriching part of the relationship. And he doesn't talk about it all that much with Becca, but it is there for us. And it certainly has shocks that he believes that he's survived, but I think the book says that he hasn't survived them, really, but that they will be used, like other shocks that the book talks about. They will be used, transformed.
I've been talking with Joseph McElroy, author most recently of Actress in the House, published by Overlook Press, who are also republishing his first novel, A Smuggler's Bible. His huge book, Women and Men, is available from Dalkey Archive Press, and gradually all of his work is coming back into print. He's one of the writers that not only do I most admire, he has succeeded in repeatedly submerging me in a world in his novels that I don't see in other books and yet that I recognize as existing. That is to say, for some reason, this particular writer seems to have been able to create on the page a modern consciousness that others have suspected can no longer be rendered in language, and it strikes me as an extraordinary achievement. Thank you, Joe, for joining
me. Thank you, Michael.
You can read the first chapter of Actress in the House on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Everything, they're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now with Book of the Mouse Club Time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.